Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor David Hayton. Professor Hayton is Emeritus Professor of History at Queen's University Belfast. He has worked in the history of Parliament Trust, editing the volumes dealing with the House of Commons between 1690 and 1715. He is a member of the Irish Academy. And today we are speaking about his new book, Conservative Revolutionary, The Lives of Louis Nemeri, published by Manchester University Press. Welcome, Professor Hayton.
It's nice to be here.
Professor, what is the genesis of this book?
Well, I worked, as you say, for the History of Parliament Trust, which was the institution, I suppose, most closely associated with Sir Louis Nemeri. And in his last 10 years, it occupied all his time. And by the time I worked there, I was far too young to know Nemeri. He died in 1960. But his presence was still there, and people talked about him. There were plenty of people who knew him and regarded him as the most impressive person they'd ever encountered intellectually. So I was, in a way, indoctrinated into thinking how important he was. And I obviously had read his work in any case. But it was when I was trying to write the introductory survey to our volumes in the early 18th century that I got very interested in the history of the history, and I started looking into the archive. And while I was there, I found 20 boxes of Nemeri papers, which had never, to my knowledge, been used by anybody who was interested in Nemeri as such. His widow, who wrote a biography of him, which was published 10 years after he died, was not interested in the material he left in his office, which is what those 20 boxes were. She was not interested really in his history writing. It was about him as a person and his public career that she was concerned. So these were entirely new. And then I began to find more and more material. And I always feel that you know you've got a good subject when everything you look at turns up something of value. So that's really, I kind of fell into doing it. And indeed, I had met before they died, a number of people who worked very closely with Nemeri, and had I been thinking of writing a biography, I'd have talked to them then and there, but I didn't. And by the time I was interested, it was too late. So I should have really been planning this from a long way, but it happened by kind of serendipity, really.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sir Louis's family background in pre-1914 Habsburg Galicia, and I suppose before that in Warsawa?
Yes, his family was Jewish on both sides. His father's family were fairly well-to-do liberal Jews in Russian Poland. I mean, they were very well-to-do, I think, but that can't be proved. On his mother's side, his maternal grandfather was a a landowner and industrialist in Galicia, which you couldn't be in Russian Poland. You could be in Habsburg Poland. And after the marriage, his parents moved down from Warsaw down to a series of small towns south of what was then Lemberg, which is now Lviv, in East Galicia, moving down towards almost the Romanian border. His father, having trained as a lawyer, wasn't very much good at that and was also rather idle and I think a bit of a gambler, and ended up really working for his father-in-law, managing estates and managing his father-in-law's distilleries, and eventually bought an estate called Kozłowice in what is now Ukraine, or his name you would have said Ukraine, that's how he always pronounced it apparently, but which was then in the Habsburg Empire. And Namir described himself as the son of a gentleman when he went to Oxford, but it was only a very recent acquisition, the gentry estate. And then, of course, these were fairly cosmopolitan. His mother had been to university in Germany for a while. Family spoke French and Polish at home. They were strong Polish nationalists, and his father was an old-style liberal, which Ludwig, as he was then, Ludwig Bernstein, could not abide. He became a Slavophile, which is very unusual for an East European Jew, even though Russia ought to have been associated with persecution of Jews. In fact, he became a pan-Slavist under the influence of one of his tutors. So his family background was fairly prosperous. He was privately educated, and then he went to university first in Lemberg, and then in Lausanne briefly, and then in England.
How and why did he end up as an undergraduate at Oxford?
Well, when he first came to England, he came to the London School of Economics. And it was really because at that time he was quite left-wing in his views. He'd been a socialist as a young man, quite an advanced socialist. And he always denied that he was a Marxist. You could be guaranteed to infuriate him by suggesting he was. But he'd always been very left-wing from about the age of 12 or 13 onwards. And he came at Lausanne under the influence of Pareto, the Italian sociologist and economist. And I think through various hints from people he knew at Lemberg and in Lausanne, he thought the LSE was the best place to be. And when he went to the LSE, he became a Fabian and immersed himself into that world, but he didn't like it very much. He seems not to have liked the physical appearance and the environment of London very much, and he was always unhappy. And his one of his tutors, a man called Edvard Westermarck, a very famous anthropologist, wrote to Oxford, wrote to Balliol College and said, you really should take this man because he's the most brilliant student we've ever had. And Balliol, who were a very broad-minded college in Edwardian Oxford, they had a number of Jewish undergraduates, although they tended to regard Jewish undergraduates with a certain amount of not quite disdain, but a certain patronizing quality. But they were also, at that time, a very left-wing college imbued with the ethos of Christian socialism. And the leading light in the college, though he was not yet master, Arthur Smith, took a shine to Namir, and they admitted him. And when he got there, of course, it was as though he'd found his home in life.
What did Sir Lewis make of Oxford, and what did Oxford make of Sir Lewis?
Well, he loved it. And for the rest of his life, he was always trying to get back. And it was a cause of great pain to him that actually Oxford didn't want him sufficiently to have him back. he was intoxicated by the intellectual atmosphere of Oxford, particularly of Balliol College, which was, you know, out by some distance the most brilliant intellectual college in the university. He also found that England, unlike as he saw it, Habsburg Austria and its dominions, and unlike Russia, was a society which was open to the talents. Ordinary businessmen could make their way into the English upper classes. So it's been said that he idealized the English aristocracy, and I think that's it's partly true, but he idealized it because he thought that these were the people who were rulers of empire, destined to be rulers of empire, and generally were disinterested, public-spirited. This is how he saw them. It's not necessarily, of course, how they were. And they belonged to an upper class which was rooted in English history, which again was unlike the Polish upper class in Galicia, which was more like a colonial class. And it was also a kind of aristocracy which people like his grandfather could have and did move into, although it took them a bit of time to do it. So he really loved Oxford, and he particularly moved in circles which were concerned with, people who were concerned with imperial questions. He began at that point to get very, very interested in what he called the Anglo-Saxon empires, which he defined as Britain and the USA. He had friends from Canada, Australia, and one particular friend from America, Whitney Shepherdson, who was already very interested in the American Revolution, why it had happened, and so on. And he also became involved with groups like the Round Table, progressive imperial federalists around Lionel Curtis. But what Oxford made of him is a different matter. He was regarded as a strange person. Within Balliol, there were a number of very successful Jewish undergraduates who became president of the union and what have you. They tended to be from English public school backgrounds. Naimi was very different. He came from Eastern Europe. He had a very pronounced guttural accent. He managed to survive simply, I think, because of his strangeness. He was not... There's a very interesting comparison with a fellow undergraduate at New College, slightly older than Naimi, Harry Sacker, who became a journalist on the Manchester Guardian and a very strong Zionist like Naimi. And Sacker did not enjoy his time at Oxford, as far as I could tell from his autobiography, and he felt he was always discriminated against because his father was a tailor in the East End of London. He wasn't a public school boy. Well, Naimi could at least claim to be of gentry stock, which he did. He was regarded as an eccentric, but never really taken to Oxford's bosom very much. Even the people who were the most supportive of him in many respects, if you read their letters, they have this slight distance from him. Smith, who was his great supporter, became Master of Balliol in the 1920s, actually said in one of his letters, you know, I must tell you straight away that he is, as his name suggests, a Jew, with all that that implies. Well, of course, I never was quite sure what all that implied, but presumably his readers would have been. So Oxford thought he was a character. They knew he was a brilliant man, but they never really, his tutors and his colleagues never really took him to their hearts.
At this early time at Oxford, did the origins of this legend, or perhaps it's not a legend, I presume it is, though, that Sir Lewis was, I think the expression from the Trevor Roper correspondence is, quote, history's greatest bore,
yes,
unquote.
Well, I think there's a great deal of truth in it. Even his wife called him a monomaniac. And he always assumed that the workings of his own mind and what was interesting to him would be of profound interest to everybody else. So there are plenty of stories when he was in Oxford of him holding forth on the subject of Eastern Europe and the Jewish question to his fellow undergraduates, who, of course, knew nothing of either, most of them. Even the most gifted found nameless discussions of the various territories of the Habsburg Empire completely mystifying because they had no idea where they were. So there is that sense straight away that he didn't know. One of his tutors said he never knows when to leave my rooms. I suppose nowadays we would possibly say that he was on the spectrum. Not quite, the social antennae weren't quite that developed. But he did, of course, make a number of friends, both as an undergraduate and subsequently as a tutor, and people who remained his friends for life.
How important for Sir Lewis was the, I suppose it's 18 months to 2 years, time that he spent in America before in the early portion of the Great War?
I think they were profoundly important. When he came to America, he'd already begun work on what was to be a lifetime's project on trying to understand how the American Revolution had happened. And he was at that time looking largely at printed material, at pamphlets and so on. When he came to America, now he was working, and he makes great play in one of his books with the face, holier than thou, sanctimonious way of saying it, because he was in America where libraries are open at the weekends and in the evenings, he could carry on with his research, assuming, of course, that the reader would think, well, people back in Oxford would stop work at 6 o'clock. But he used a lot of material in American archives, in Harvard, in New York, in the New York Public Library, and at Yale. He used to visit various people at Yale. And C.M. Andrews, who was his, I suppose, the person who set him on the road, advised him not to study the American side, but to study the English side, where not enough work had been done. And it's also, I think, undeniable that he was influenced by Charles Beard, although he never said so himself, and his widow never said so. Beard's great book, on the American Revolution, which used some of the techniques that Namier had used, was a kind of revisionist book in its time, appeared while he was working in New York. He could easily have gone to see Beard, although there's no evidence that he did. But he was very fond of saying during the 1920s that while British historians were hopeless, particularly those dealing with the 18th century, there were some very fine historians in America. And indeed, the only decent work being done on 18th century British history was being done in America. So I think he was profoundly influenced in that time. And it, I think Beard in particular, because Beard uses some of the same techniques, although in a more limited way than Namier does. Beard, when he's looking at the membership of the Continental Congresses, and he's looking at the individuals and atomizing the Congress and then trying to build up a picture from the individual biographies. So that's exactly, of course, what Namier did later on. So I think his time in America was profoundly important. He nearly stayed in America. Of course, he was going, before the First World War broke out, he was going to study law in St. Louis. And as I said in the book, then a lot of Midwestern attorneys should be grateful for the fact that he didn't.
Yes, and no doubt judges as well, since they have been the recipients of his legal discourse in court. How did Sir Lewis end up at Wellington House during the Great War, doing war work, and what exactly he was doing there?
Well, he joined up. He came back to fight for King and adopted country. He was naturalized by that time and saw himself as British. And he didn't actually fire a gun in anger. He did a lot of training. And then some of his friends, he thought his friends in Oxford, but not in Oxford, in fact, some of his friends who were aware of his remarkable knowledge of Eastern European politics and societies and his command of languages, felt that he would be useful in the Department of Information in Wellington House, essentially preparing material at that stage for newspaper reports that were being issued, particularly in America. I mean, his connection with having worked in America, that was extremely important because they felt that he could assist in promoting the British cause to the American population. But very soon he moved from the Department of Information, or Misinformation, as it was sometimes jocularly called, to the Intelligence Bureau, which was not intended really to provide propaganda material, but to provide advice to government. And that was eventually moved lock, stock and barrel into the Foreign Office as the what was called the Political Intelligence Department. And there what he did was, I mean, he read newspapers, he read dispatches, he read secret material, and he provided what we would now think of as background papers on particular issues to government. He provided analyses of particular incidents and episodes. He also provided, which he probably shouldn't have done. In fact, he was told not to. He provided opinions and advice on what government should do in relation to principally the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and as it developed during the war, policy towards Poland. They were his two principal areas of interest.
Did his war work have any influence on his future career as a historian?
Well, I think it did in some respects. I mean, it was a very good training for the historian to have to work through a range of documentary material very quickly and to produce these tightly written position papers. But also, I think it helped him in several ways. He always had a great interest in European history, and it sharpened his obsession with 19th century Europe and the world that had come to an end, really, was brought to an end in the 1418 War. And he wrote, as well as his work on English history, he wrote many articles and essays and book reviews on European history and projected any number of books on European history. And a lot of that material came from, all of the interest in that material came from working in the Foreign Office and seeing all this material close at hand. I think he also began to develop certain traits that you can spot in his later work. One of the necessities in providing these position papers was to provide what is now popularly known as evidence-based arguments. So he had always to essentially count, how many Poles, how many Jews, how many Ukrainians were in a particular part of Galicia. Should this go to Poland? Should this go to the Ukraine? Should it go to Russia? He also had to analyze a raft of really sometimes very misleading, deliberately misleading pieces of evidence, newspaper reports, press material coming out of either the Central Powers or the right-wing nationalists in Poland, of whom he was always very suspicious. So I think some of the practices that he then later brought to his 18th century history began when he was working in what was known as the PID, the Political Intelligence Department.
Why did Sir Lewis fail to obtain a permanent post at Oxford after he left the Foreign Office in 1920?
Yes, that's a very tricky one. He was determined to leave, and eventually in 1920 he did. Partly he left a little bit early out of disgust at the way not so much British policy was going, but Allied policy was going. He was committed to the notion that Poland should, an independent Polish state, such as had been created at the end of the First World War, should not acquire land to which it was not entitled by demography, really. So Polish aims in Lithuania, in Belarus, and especially in East Galicia, were things that he worked very hard to try and defeat. But a combination of French and American, and to some extent British policy, meant that his ideas came to nothing. So he left slightly early. And all that could be found for him in Oxford was what we would now think of as a tutorial assistantship. He taught young men in tutorials at piecework rates, you know, so much an hour. He gave lectures to try and show how great he was, and he wasn't paid for the first year of those. And second year, he was only paid about 3 years later. He was, it seemed to me, quite shabbily treated in Oxford, and it's hard to put one's finger on it. It may be that he was just seen as too intense, too difficult a person. There may well have been some anti-Semitic element, because he hadn't been appointed, he hadn't been elected as a Fellow of All Souls before the First World War, quite clearly because of anti-Semitism. He was also by this time quite an active Zionist, and I suspect that this made him appear, if it's not an absurdity, more Jewish than he was. He was not a practicing Jew. He never was. But his association with Zionism made people, I think, feel that he was, you know, an ultra Jewish individual. And there was still a certain amount of anti-Jewish, quite a lot of it, prejudice in Oxford. So he would never have admitted that himself. In fact, he made all sorts of excuses why he was not appointed. But I suspect that was a very strong reason. That and a certain intensity and difficult qualities, personal qualities, intensity of personality and rather combative personality that made him not quite persona grata in senior common rooms, which was extraordinary because so many of the people that he'd been undergraduates with at Balliol already had Oxford fellowships, including people that he had tutored more or less through their finals. It must have been extremely frustrating.
Why did Sir Lewis become a Zionist?
Well, that, I think, is a very difficult question. And it's when and why is something I was never able in the book to give a firm answer to. When he was talking in later years to his widow, whom he wished to write his biography and more or less dictated bits of it to, he said that he was slowly moving towards a Zionist position, really from the time that he went to Lemberg University in 1908. Well, I just don't see that at all. I think that's an ex post facto rationalization. Where we see him beginning to take a very strong Zionist view is around 1918-1919. And between, we'll say, 1918 and 1920, I think he embraces the Zionist project. And partly it is that he meets and is very heavily influenced by Weizmann, Chaim Weizmann, who was a kind of almost like a father figure to him, a surrogate father, because he didn't get on with his own father. But also because I think while he was in the PID, he was seeing all these papers come before him detailing, on the one hand, atrocities against pogroms and murders of Jews in Eastern Europe, and also seeing the way these were excused and indeed gloried in by some elements of the right-wing press in Eastern Europe, and also finding an institutionalized anti-Semitism in some areas of the Foreign Office, which meant that he couldn't get these ideas across. So I think that's increasing frustration and the as a pull factor, I think, the influence of Weizmann and of Leonard Stein, who was a friend of his from Balliol, who was at that time political secretary of the Zionist movement, that drew him into Zionism around the 1920s. And then he starts in the 20s to attend Zionist congresses and so on.
How different in terms of content and form, and I suppose the novelty aspect as well as future importance, was his first historical book, The Structure of Politics at the Ascension of George III?
Well, it seemed to contemporaries to be very novel. This is a book that he'd been working on, off and on, really since about 1912, when he began to write about the American Revolution and the sundering of the great of the British Empire, which he felt was a very, very important milestone in world history, and affected not just American politics or British politics, but European politics. But he'd started to work on this really from the perspective of trying to understand the arguments. And gradually he began to think that what was important was understanding the flow of events. How had the American Revolution happened? What had been the mainsprings of the decisions made in Britain in the 1750s and 60s, which had precipitated war? And he began to look at the background, the political, the parliamentary background. And in order to do so, because of this training in the Foreign Office where he had to provide, you know, statistical evidence-based arguments, he began to want to answer, questions about the nature of government, the nature of parliamentary support for each side, and he needed figures to do this. It was no good saying that a majority of members of parliament were Whigs, a majority were Tories, a majority were this, that, and the other. He needed to know what parties there were. So he began to look at individuals and to try and calculate, you know, how many what one might call Tories, what one might call government Whigs, opposition Whigs. He very quickly discovered what some historians had already discovered, that parties in the parliament in the 1760s was not a two-party system or a three-party system, but a multi-party system. And the key to understanding how elections were called and their results and how ministries were made and unmade was to understand the maneuverings of factions attached to the leading politicians of the day. Now, he wasn't the first person to do this, but he was the first person to do it in authoritative depth. So he provided numbers and lists for membership of particular factions. But he also felt, and one of the things about Naomi is that he always wanted to find out as much as he could about everything. In fact, you could say he wanted to know everything about everything. So he started off asking one question, and then in order to answer that, he had to ask another question, and in order to answer that, he needed to ask a further question. So he was always going deeper and deeper into the material. And his first book was, as he would have said, a prolegomena. It was a prologue to what was intended as a multi-volume narrative of the period 1754 to 1776, which would have brought the story of English politics, English policymaking, right through to the American Revolution. So he set out to answer various questions about Parliament. And he did so by using material drawn from a vast range of primary sources, manuscript sources, which had not been used before. He went through, most famously, the Newcastle Papers in the British Museum. But he also dug out and made use of family collections which had never been seen. And one of the things which made such an impact from the first and the second book, and they follow very closely together, and they're both really scene-setting books. They describe the British political system, and they then, in the second book, you hear the results of the election of 1761, the first major turning point in his period. But it is the depth, the archival richness that he was able to show, his familiarity with the material, which was by far in excess of anything anyone else had ever written. Now, he also made arguments about George III, debunking the notion that George III had come to the throne in 1760 determined to recover the prerogatives of the crown that his father had allowed to wither, and that he took a ruthless attitude to try and increase the power of the crown, advised by his favourites of Lord Bute, and making use of patronage and pensions and places to buy a majority for the crown in the House of Commons. Namely, debunked this in a way that it hadn't been debunked before. And I suppose that is what is essentially novel about the book. Is the argument about George III. But in fact, what was really extraordinary to contemporaries and what they picked up on was the depth of knowledge, the fact that he was able to write about completely obscure people as though he knew them. And he was able to create a world which people hadn't seen before. So instead of the rather old-fashioned constitutional history of the Whigs, you now had a picture of the Parliament of the 1760s as it must have appeared to contemporaries. And people would, reviewers said, Mr. Namier knows more about the world of the 1760s than even the people who lived there.
Why was the second book, England in the Age of the American Revolution, not as well received as Structure?
Yes, that's an interesting one. I think one of his close friends, the conservative politician Walter Elliott, argued that, you know, when the first book had come out, it was such a different kind of book than anything that had appeared before, that Namier was a kind of unknown figure, and everybody bowed down before the unknown god, as Elliott put it. When the second book came out, he was a known quantity. And what they were getting was, in fact, really more of the same. And they were expecting, I think that some readers were expecting, now he's cleared the undergrowth in the first book. He's now going to build. And he didn't actually build. There was much more clearing of undergrowth and a very limited amount of explanation of why the Bute Newcastle Ministry came into being and even to a lesser extent, why it ceased to come into being, ceased to exist, so that a lot of readers felt, well, you know, this is the second book is much the same as the first. He's not answered the big questions. They were expecting big questions to be answered, and they weren't. In due course, had he been able to finish his projected work, one presumes that big questions would have been answered if he hadn't been sidetracked. But I think there's a slight sense of disappointment with the second book, which upset him a bit, I think. He was expecting to be lionized much as he had been with the first one.
Now, in the early 30s, he finally obtains, after so long a time period, an academic post at Manchester. What sort of teacher was he?
Well, those who were taught by him, some of whom recorded their reminiscences, and others from a later generation I was able to talk to, some of his latter pupils, said that he was, for good students, he was a marvelous teacher, because he took them seriously, he didn't talk down to them, he knew a tremendous amount, but he was willing to be corrected if they could find any mistakes in his work. In fact, he was thrilled if one of his students found something that he'd said that was wrong. And he took endless amounts of time and trouble with the brighter students. Now, that has to be said, the brighter students. He didn't really do much teaching in the general courses. He stuck with what were called the honors students, who were a minority. Most of the students were reading for a pass degree or a joint degree, and they were pushed through a kind of sausage machine of lectures and exams by the assistant lecturers. Namier liked to deal principally with honors students in their final year. He also liked to teach and examine what he wanted to teach and examine. In a way that I think people nowadays, academics nowadays, would think was very advanced. I mean, he had the most extraordinary set of exam questions, which I don't think I could have got away with when I was teaching. You know, one of them was, I think, what is and should be in a newspaper. Now, asking a student that, I think nowadays, well, they'd be baffled, but also it would be far too broad. He also couldn't stand the normal examination system. He liked, you know, to set a particular type of examination. You could do one question rather than three. You could write on what you liked. The students could invigilate themselves and so on. So I think he was, nowadays he'd be seen as innovative. At the time, I think he was seen as terribly self-indulgent. But because he was so important, he could get away with it. And he didn't do that much administration. So it was great with the better students, not so good with the ordinary students. And indeed, he himself said that what he really should be doing was training researchers. That's what he ought to be doing. And he once suggested that he be given a job in America at Yale, I think, just training researchers. He would have loved that.
Now, in Manchester in the early 30s is where he first met with and entered into a very strong friendship with A.J.P. Taylor, Alan Taylor. Can you describe a little bit their early relationship?
Yes, Taylor was already appointed at Manchester. He was an assistant lecturer, I think, had already been in Manchester a year before Namier arrived. And he was brought in a moment of desperation by the head of the department, who had nobody to teach 19th century Europe. And I suspect that was Namier's great attraction as well, that he could teach 19th century Europe. So Namier took Taylor under his wing, and he made sure that Taylor finished a PhD thesis, although he himself despised the notion of a doctorate. He thought it was far too Germanic. He made sure that Taylor published his thesis. He made sure that Taylor got work book reviewing for the Manchester Guardian and for weeklies. And I think, although the evidence, a lot of our evidence comes from Taylor, but it looks as though Namier acted as a kind of academic godfather to Taylor. Taylor himself, especially after Namier died, was very anxious not to be described as a protege of Namier or a pupil of Namier, which he said he never was. And in fact, his autobiography argues that, in fact, rather than Namier telling him what to do, he had to tell Namier what to do. Namier had no experience of lecturing or teaching in a provincial university. So Taylor had to tell him, how to do this, how to do that, how to set paper, exam papers, what to mark, and so on. I find that a little bit self-serving. I suspect the truth is, as always, somewhere in between. I think that Taylor probably did have to assist Namier in certain administrative matters, but on the whole, in terms of in terms of Taylor's intellectual development, it's very much Namier, who is the dominant figure. And a lot of the ideas that one sees subsequently in Taylor's writings, his tendency in some of his books to poo-poo public opinion, for example, or his not quite as severe as Namir, but his Germanophobia, his dislike of German nationalism, I think is taken very much from Namir. Taylor was always rather more radical of the two. Namir's radical past was long gone by the 1930s. He described himself as a Tory radical, but more a Tory than a radical. Taylor was still very much the nonconformist, radical, liberal, and politically they weren't quite on the same wavelength, but in almost every other respect they were.
Why was Sir Lewis so early on able to identify the expansionist and hegemonic dangers of National Socialist Germany?
Well, it fitted very closely with his reading of German nationalism. He had certain idées fixes about Europe. The most important was that the single most dangerous feature of the 19th century was the rise of German nationalism. And he always felt that German nationalism, unlike the nationalism of the Czechs, for example, or indeed of the Italians, German nationalism was always expansionist by nature. It was almost as if he was doing a psychoanalysis of the German character, and saw expansionist nationalism as its natural emanation. And his arguments about the First World War is that it's caused by, you know, the expansion of German and Austrian national movements from Central Europe towards the East. That's what brought about the First World War. And in a way, simply he reads Hitler as a more malign, but a very similar phenomenon to Prussianism in the late 19th century, or the Kaiser before the First World War. Hitler, he argued, was the perfect example, or the perfect expression of the German national character, which is, of course, not a phrase really that one can agree with, but it was very much a belief that he had, and he always believed that Germans were imaginatively limited. I mean, it's almost like a caricature, and that they were, their cruelty would be systematic cruelty rather than the cruelty of the Tatar or the whoever else. It would be systematic scientific cruelty. And of course, then, to some extent, he was there. He was proved right. So he always felt that Hitler was a menace from even before the time that he took over, simply because he thought that Hitler would gather popular support in Germany to himself. And he understood an anti-Semite when he saw one.
I noted that Sir Lewis, during the Second World War, became friends with, of all people, St. John Philby, Kim Philby's father.
Yes.
Did that friendship survive Philby's imprisonment?
That I don't know. I don't think so. You don't hear much about Philby later on in Namir's correspondence. He was, I think, he admired Philby in the way that he admired T.E. Lawrence, who was a friend at Oxford, and Ord Wingate, who was the cousin of his university friend, Ronald Wingate. And he was very attached to all of them because they were, in a sense, they were romantic heroes. They were men of action. And Namir, who is in many respects a collection of paradoxes, although he's ultimately himself a man of the library and of the study, he admired romantic heroes. He once claimed that he had been one of Pilsudski's marksmen in Poland in the period before the First World War. He'd been prepared to take up arms for Polish nationalism then. And the relationship with Philby is a strange one. He lived quite nearby Philby's wife, and was quite friendly with her. And he was also able to sometimes, I think, make distinctions between the ideas of his friends and the ideas of of other people, which might be the same as his friends, but they weren't. They weren't his friends. If you follow what I'm saying, he could make excuses for friends of his who were anti-Semitic in the 1930s. He could make excuses for friends of his who supported the Munich Agreement, which he absolutely loathed. And in the case of St. John Philby, he could make excuses for Philby's strong Arabist sympathies, partly because he believed that this was not altogether removed from his own strong Zionist sympathies, and it's the same with Lawrence, and the two could coexist, that you could have a Jewish state and you could have an Arab state, and the coexistence of these two states, which of course would have been difficult, he took for granted. And so he was not necessarily opposed to some of Philby's ideas, if he felt it could, that the Zionist movement could profit by them.
How do you explain Sir Lewis's post-war fame and eminence, the failure to obtain a Regius professorship at Cambridge or Oxford apart?
Well, his name was a very well-known figure in the 1930s. His two books had established him as the preeminent authority on 18th century England, or at least that's how he appeared in the public mind. He then began to write after the Second World War in a rather different framework. He wrote this great book, Diplomatic Prelude, analyzing the foreign policy of European countries in the lead up to Munich and beyond. And he therefore established himself as an authority on European, contemporary European history. But he was also reviewing very widely. And that's sometimes underestimated, the value of these reviews. In a way, the number of book reviews he did was a dissipation of his talents. Instead of writing big works of European or British history, he wrote endless, longish book reviews and then gathered them together in collections. But they were themselves very impressive. There's a wonderful stylistic strength in them, muscularity in them, and very often these wonderful aphorisms which people endlessly quote. And they glittered. And that public impression of Namier really grew up between about 45 and about 1953-54. At that point, he's at the height of his fame. He's a public intellectual. He's giving talks on the BBC third program, on the radio. He's reviewing in all the quality journals. He's publishing these collections of essays. Everybody's awaiting the next great work, which never comes. So he does for a while have a position of preeminence in the public mind, but also among younger academics. Those people as different as Christopher Hill or Richard Cobb read Namier's work in the 1930s and were thrilled by it, because it seemed to be he was actually talking about worlds that actually existed rather than pontificating about traditional pictures of the past. Now, at that time, he doesn't get both Regius chairs, Cambridge and Oxford. He doesn't also get the professorship in international relations at Oxford, which he might have done. Part of this is, I think by now the anti-Semitism has faded, but it's still not gone away. And indeed, most extraordinarily, one of the obituaries published of him in an English newspaper, in the Times, in fact, there is some reference to the way the hammer blows which he dealt with a typical Jewish dexterity, which is quite uncalled for, and maybe indicates something lying beneath what was being said. But it is, I think, that he has made himself extremely unpopular in academic circles by the way that he follows up any kind of slight or insult or mistake that somebody makes. He's extremely combative. He's extremely aggressive. And I think that made him unpopular. And of course, there is this popular view of him in academic circles that he's the greatest bore ever to come out of Poland. You know, you couldn't possibly have him in a senior common room. He'd dominate conversation and so on. And there is evidence that he might very well have done that. So he has a strong popular presence as a historian in that decade after the end of the Second World War. And young historians, until the emergence of a different kind of history in the 1950s, saw him as clearly much better than anyone else. But he's personally rebarbative, I think might be the word. He's personally unpopular, and nobody will have him.
How do you explain his second marriage to Lady Julia when, in terms of personalities and interests, there's so much different people?
Yes, they were. I mean, I think he was, from all accounts, when he met her during the war at a tea party, rather intellectual tea party, one afternoon discussing Christian-Jewish relations. She was struck by his forthright way in which he expressed his views. He was simply dumbstruck by her. I think it was love at first sight in his part. He was completely thrown over by her. At that time, Nemia had a very interesting sex life. He probably had two women with whom he was conducting long-term affairs without any serious intent on his part. But as soon as he saw her, he wanted to marry her. Now, so it must be a personal attraction. And indeed, people who knew them both said that, you know, she was absolutely charming. Although Namia's secretary, one of his assistants, said to me when I mentioned Lady Namia, did she know Lady Namia? Oh, she said the Ice Queen. She could be very, very cold and not a little snobbish, I think. But most people found her of her own social class, found her charming. Now, she had a number of attractions to Namia. One was that she was from an aristocratic background, and he always prized the aristocracy. And she was also not just Russian, but a Russian Orthodox writer, and indeed a mystic, one might say. And Namia had always thought of Orthodoxy, although he was not by any means religious himself, as representing the soul of Russia, the soul of Slavdom. And he felt, I suspect, that by marrying Julia, that he was somehow uniting himself to his Slavic, well, not his Slavic heritage, but the Slavic heritage that he so much prized. So she had many attractions for him besides simply looks and personality.
We don't really know, do we, the sincerity or lack thereof in his conversion at that time of the marriage, actually before the marriage, to Anglicanism, do we?
No, we don't. People who knew him very well, Blanche Dugdale, with whom he worked for many years in the Zionist movement, you know, couldn't believe it, really. Isaiah Berlin, who knew him very well, always maintained that there was no real religious belief in Namia. Lucy Sutherland, with whom he worked on the 18th century, said that he'd once mentioned her, you know, Julia believes all that stuff, I don't. On the other hand, John Brooke, who was closest to him in his last years, said that he thought he told somebody else, and didn't say to me because he died before I could talk to him, but told an informant of mine that he felt that Namia perhaps was turning to religion in his latter years, as a lot of elderly people do when the death is approaching. But it's not at all easy to say. And I think he went through the form of conversion, baptism into the Church of England, really for form's sake, in order to marry Julia.
Why did Sir Lewis have the falling out with Alan Taylor over the Oxford Regius Professorship in 1956-57?
Well, I think simply because, you know, Taylor expected Namier to support him because he thought he was the best candidate, much indeed as Namier thought that he was the best candidate in 1947. They shared that view of their own abilities. And in the last resort, Namier clearly did not do that. We don't know much about, we know a fair bit about the election, but we don't really know for certain what happened. Namier was asked by Harold Macmillan, who was Prime Minister. Macmillan had been his publisher since 1929. They were friendly. And Namier was obviously not a candidate himself, having long retired. And Macmillan thought that he was obviously the best person to ask. So he asked Namier who he would recommend, and Namier recommended Lucy Sutherland. Now, he didn't recommend Taylor at that point. Lucy Sutherland would not take the Regis chair if it meant she gave up headship of her college, Lady Margaret Hall. So she wouldn't do that. Namier then must have talked about the other candidates, Taylor and Trevor Roper. And he must, for some reason or other, have plumped for Trevor Roper. We have some clues in comments that he made about Taylor as a potential successor at Manchester, that Taylor was very good as a historian, but too prone to show off. He must have fireworks, and they'll be his undoing, was one of Namier's phrases, and that he hadn't yet written anything, you know, so substantial and solid as in Namier's view to warrant being made professor. So I suspect he might still have had that view of Taylor in 1957, whereas he took a rather more indulgent view of Trevor Roper. It's just possible that there might have been a cooling in their relationship already on Namier's side, partly because Namier had supported the British invasion of Suez. Taylor had been violently opposed to it. And Taylor had also written some sharp reviews of some of Namier's works and some work published by Namier's pupils because he felt this was wasting Namier's talents. But I don't think Namier ever had a grudge against Taylor, in that he had grudges against so many other people. And indeed, long after the falling out between them, he tried to mend fences, build bridges, and so on, but Taylor wasn't having any.
As far as aware of, Namier didn't take umbrage, I should say, at Taylor's famous description of Sir Lewis as, quote, taking the mind out of history, unquote.
No, he didn't do that. Well, he may not have known that it was Taylor, because it comes in an unsigned article in the TLS. So, and by that time, I think Namier had fallen out with the TLS because they'd had the temerity to edit his prose. So he wouldn't have been able to ask the editor who actually wrote this. He doesn't seem to have worried over much about that. No, and indeed he didn't really worry about the criticisms leveled at him by Herbert Butterfield as criticisms. What worried him, I think, was that this would somehow reflect upon the History of Parliament project, in which he was fully engaged by that time and which was under severe pressure from the Treasury to produce or be closed down. So he didn't take umbrage, I think. And I suspect that he would have been slightly concerned himself. John Brooks suggests this, that he had neglected the broader historical developments in the pursuit of detail. He was drawn to look at the detail all the time, drawn almost into this morass of detail. But in his European history, he was able to rise above it. In his British history, he found it very difficult.
Can you explain a little bit Sir Lewis's role in the post-war History of Parliament project?
Yes, he had been involved with the first incarnation of the History of Parliament in the 1930s. It was an idea put forward by the Liberal-turned-Labour MP Josiah Wedgwood, who was something of a local antiquarian. And the idea, from Wedgwood's perspective, was to write a history of Parliament, an official history of Parliament, which would educate the world in the virtues of the British parliamentary tradition. And it was to be done by biographies, because that was, at that time, in the way Namu was writing history, other people were writing political history, and it fitted in with the tradition of the Dictionary of National Biography. Now, that project languished largely because of Wedgwood's difficult personality in the 1930s. There was still an amount of some of the funding left from Wedgwood's fundraising, and it was put in the hands of a trust, a parliamentary trust, during the war. And after the war, after the Second World War, this trust tried to revive the history of Parliament. But this time, it wasn't to be run by an amateur like Wedgwood. It was to be run by, in terms of the academic direction, by the real experts in parliamentary history. And these were namely Sir John Neill and several others. So Namu was brought into a small editorial board which governed the academic direction of the history from 1951 onwards. And very quickly, that editorial board resolved itself into a conflict between Namu and Neill on different approaches to writing the history of Parliament. Namu had never been a prosopographer in the way that the classical historians of the 19th century were prosopographers, or in the way that Charles Beard had been a prosopographer. He never sought to simply list certain characteristics of members in order to understand either their how their backgrounds affected their views as a group, or how their, in the case of Beard and American revolutionaries, how their economic interests determined their particular political positions. Namu, because he wanted to find out everything about everything, did a different type of prosopography. His prosopography was trying to find out everything about these people, even to the extent of psychoanalyzing them. And it didn't seem to be going anywhere in particular. Neill, on the other hand, had a very simple and straightforward view. He needed to find out how many MPs were Puritans, how many MPs were landowners, how many MPs were in trade, and then you could make some generalizations about the behavior of the House of Commons. Namu didn't want to do that. He wanted to look at all the, he was a perfect, empiricist. He wanted to look at all the information he could possibly look at and then come to conclusions. And it in fact was Namu's vision that the history eventually adopted, of writing relatively full biographies, which didn't seek to answer a set of pre-prepared questions, which was Neill's view, but were expansive and revealed their general questions when all the material was at hand, which is, of course, a very difficult way to do it.
What, if anything, remains of the once vast influence on the historical profession of Sir Lewis?
Well, I suspect that what he is probably still associated with is multi-biographical analysis, the idea that in order to understand an institution, or whether it be a representative assembly or a civil service or a political class, you write biographies of each of the, or study the biographies of each of the individuals, and then you put it all together as a group. And that kind of multi-biographical approach is still used. It's used by the History of Parliament, but it's used more broadly. And I think that, as far as the dictionary definition of Namierism is concerned, I think it is a long-lasting influence. I suspect that his attitude to public opinion and to political ideas, which has often been caricatured, I think, by historians of ideas, is no longer widely accepted, but is nonetheless still influential. The notion that individuals don't act in pursuit of a rational set of principles, that they are affected by their personal interests, whether it be material self-interest, the need to assuage some kind of deep psychological problem they might have. This view of the world is still, this view of politics is still present. It's not as powerful as it would have been perhaps when Namier was writing in the 1950s. His interest in the psychology of the persons in the past. He was himself a Freudian. He was psychoanalyzed from the 1920s right through to the late 1940s. He tried to psychoanalyze some of the individuals he wrote about, whether it be George III, Charles James Fox, or whoever. That seems to still be an element in contemporary historiography. But I suspect that Namier's real and lasting influence lies in his writings rather than in his method, his approaches, his arguments. And those writings are still accessible. They're still influential. You may disagree with them, but they have to be considered. They have to be confronted. He is still quoted extensively for some of the more remarkable phrases in his book reviews and essays. The one that I saw most recently, people don't always think, they sometimes merely wobble with the brain, and sometimes the brain doesn't wobble. I've seen that quoted about five or six times in newspapers this year. So he is still an influence in that way. Otherwise, he stands, I think, as an exemplar of a certain type of historiography, which in the days of that we're in now, the writing of social history and cultural history, is obviously less immediately influential on research students or academic historians or whatever.
So you would agree with Jonathan Clark that Namieri was not an influence on, say, the Peterhouse School?
I think not an influence directly, because I suspect the Peterhouse School looked consciously towards Butterfield and Butterfield's argument about the importance of narrative. Nonetheless, the key figure in the Peterhouse School is obviously Maurice Cowling. If one reads some of Cowling, you can't but detect an influence of Namier in the approach that perhaps politicians may take great decisions simply for reasons of immediate political advantage. I mean, that's something that Namier would have been happy to argue, though he wouldn't necessarily have said that all politicians operate in exactly that way. So I think there is a generic influence from Namier. I think without Namier, you wouldn't have got the Peterhouse School of high political historians. But they're not obviously following in Namier's footsteps, because he didn't see himself as a high political historian. He saw himself as a sociological historian of politics.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
that Namir, far from being a timeless, that Namir's ideas, far from being a timeless expression of a particular cynical, materialist, conservative view of politics, are in fact a product of a particular set of experiences and cultural influences in his adolescence and early manhood. So he is a creature, really, of the period 1895 to 1920, not a representative of one particular view of looking at human society and looking at the past, which has always been there and always will be.
Well, with that comment, Professor, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Hayton.
Thank you very much indeed.